the flesh pots of Egypt. Now there's an image to make the mouth water. My own experience of them was not entirely happy. Feeling very hot and thirsty in the Valley of the Kings, I made the mistake of buying a glass of orange squash. The result was several days in bed and frequent internal upsets. Jippy tummy, they used to call it. Well, it's in our nature to look back at the past with rose-tinted spectacles, so I'm not surprised that once the euphoria at escaping from slavery in Egypt had worn off, and there was nothing to eat in the wilderness, pictures of meat, fish, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic should have filled the hungry imaginations of the children of Israel. The culinary details come from the equivalent passage in the Book of Numbers. It was all too easy to forget the other side of the story, the back-breaking labor, the cruelty of their overseers, the sense of being pawns in someone else's game. Full bellies and shackles, or empty stomachs and freedom? Give us the flesh pots any time. The problem with freedom is that you must take responsibility for your own future. You must make it for yourself instead of having it imposed on you, whether you like it or not. You can't blame anyone else if things go wrong, though we usually do. And time after time in human history, the same pattern repeats itself. After the first flush of revolution, after the exhilaration of booting out dictators and tyrants, the sober reality of reconstruction, the realization in the cold light of day that you've got more work to do and more frustration to endure than you could ever have imagined if society is to be rebuilt and flourish. Freedom is a hard slog. So much easier to let someone else do it all for you. Someone perhaps who has no moral scruples and who deludes you into giving up freedom's dearly won by lies you kind of want to believe. Then comes the jackboot, the imprisonment, the murder of those who dare to resist. I don't want to linger any more among the fleshpots, except to say that in the face of all this complaining, God sent quails and manna. A bit short on five a day, but never mind. I like the fact that manna comes from the Hebrew, which means, what is it? As the children of Israel certainly didn't know, and scholars have argued about it ever since. Instead, there's another scene before us, which forms the setting for one of the parables found only in Matthew's Gospel. To appreciate it, we need to think back to a world before any kind of social security, a world in which if you had no work, you and your family would soon find yourselves in a precarious situation. In many countries, it was, and in some still is the case, that men looking for work would gather at certain times in public places and wait for a potential employer to hire them for the day. If you were lucky, you got picked and your family ate. If not, destitution was never far around the corner. Some of the medieval fairs which take place in this country had their origins as hiring fairs. So it's a very familiar scene to those who are listening to Jesus. There are other things it's useful to know before we delve any further. Only the very wealthy could afford to plant vineyards because you had to wait several years before you could harvest your first crop of grapes. The owner was almost always an absentee landlord who handed over the running of the estate to his agent or manager. And the accepted daily wage for a day laborer was one denarius, a Roman silver coin. And that was enough to keep the wolf from the door. So far, so good. But parables always have a twist. They're meant to make you think, ask questions of yourself. Last week, Richard reflected on one about debt and forgiveness, This week it's a story about work and pay, and there isn't half a twist. In fact, you can tell it's not as simple as it seems because some of the details don't fit. The owner plays a much more prominent part than you would expect from an absentee landlord. Why didn't he or his manager realise that they would need more workers? Why did they keep on having to go back to hire extra hands? And when it comes to payment, why are those who were hired last paid first, in full view of those who had sweated all day in the boiling heat? Clearly, this is meant to lead up to the famous saying that the first shall be last and the last first. But if you or I had been among those who'd been hired at 6 or 9 in the morning and then saw that those who'd only done 1 hour to our 12 or more were being paid the same, wouldn't we be right to think it very unfair? Surely we should have been better rewarded than them. I took a quick look at what some of the earliest commentators had to say. They were almost entirely concerned with what the different times of day meant in terms of spiritual history. Was it Adam at 6 o'clock, Moses at 9, and so on? Many of them interpreted those who started work at 5 in the afternoon as the Gentiles, lately come to salvation. But it doesn't seem to me that that's the real point. Nor does the parable propose a new kind of economic policy. 1 denarius was a fair wage and enabled those employed to provide for themselves and their families, and the earlier workers had all agreed to it. The reversal of expectations is deliberately provocative. That is because the values of God's kingdom are different from those we are used to in everyday life, individually and in community. I'm sure that when he spoke these words, Jesus also had in mind the vineyard of Israel planted by the Lord in Isaiah 5, which yielded only small and sour fruit. When the Lord came to gather the grapes, he found bloodshed instead of justice, and the cry of the oppressed instead of righteousness. There are still many governments which are very good at shedding blood and attempting to silence those who protest, then lying through their teeth about it. We might even wonder what kind of signal our own government's stated intention to break the terms of an international treaty it negotiated and signed is giving in terms of moral integrity and the rule of the law. But what exactly are the values the parable asks us to consider? We need to look at its context. Immediately beforehand, Peter has asked Jesus what kind of reward he and the other disciples may expect for having left everything behind to follow him. Jesus responds with the same words as he does at the end of the parable: many who are first will be last, and the last will be first. And then afterwards, the mother of two of the disciples puts on her proper Jewish mama act when she asks Jesus if her boys can have pride of place in his kingdom. "That's not for me to decide," he replies, before telling the disciples that true greatness lies in service. If you want to be first, you must be a servant, as he himself is. In other words, you shouldn't expect rewards for following him, not the kind which notch up points on some kind of spiritual loyalty card. That's not how it works. So he imagines a scene in which everyone is paid a living wage, but not for the same amount of work. Parables tend to ask uncomfortable questions and provide uncomfortable answers. My neighbour is the person who doesn't belong to my community. Or, what kind of soil do you think you are? Have you learned the hard lessons of forgiveness? And here, are you following me because you expect something for yourself? To be more important than others? To feel that you have earned privileges and rewards? Or is it that following me is itself the reward? The same for everyone who takes up their cross and walks my way. If we are called to discipleship, we shouldn't expect plaudits and congratulations, not from the one whose path took him to Calvary and beyond. Instead, we are called to live out the joys of faithful service, in bringing the lost safely home, restoring sight to those who have no vision, and life to those who can see no point in it. We have found these things for ourselves as we travelled along, the treasures of God's generous love offered to everyone, no matter who they are or however late they come. In any case, however long we think we have worked in the vineyard, we are all beginners in the art and science of divine love at work in this all too human world. And the reward, well, you'll have to wait for the prayer after communion for that. But I'll give you a clue. It is the same for everyone. Amen.